CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined by my co-host, Hale. We're going to do some generalizing today about philosophy. We're going to be talking about it in general. And I wanted to talk about something that I think philosophers in particular and a lot of people outside of philosophy want to know about philosophy, and that is its usefulness. Now, this is not actually something that I usually think all that much about because I don't think that thinking about the usefulness of philosophy is particularly useful in itself, kind of in an ironic way. I mean, it might not be all that useful, but so what? It might still have value. I would be willing to put my foot down and say, even if it weren't useful, so what? There's all kinds of useless things that are still valuable to us, and philosophy might just be one of them. I do, however, think that philosophy is useful, and I wanted to talk about a bit of the experiences of philosophy and how it's been useful. And one of the ways that philosophy has been useful for me is as a kind of therapeutic method, or a kind of even, I would say, not medicinal, but in the way that it tries to solve problems. Particularly philosophy's method of solving problems is, I have found, one of the more effective ways of solving its problems. Now, that's interesting. Having read a lot of philosophy, I think that's kind of, when I say it now, it actually sounds kind of ridiculous because philosophers find themselves in all kinds of problems. I'm thinking about, you know, things like Descartes' substance dualism, where he posits these two substances, mind and body, and then he spends all this time trying to figure out, okay, well, how do they interact? It's a philosophical problem because it's kind of a pseudo-problem. Philosophy finds itself in this strange thicket, this kind of unsolvable tangle, and it tries to solve all these problems that aren't even really problems. So it's really strange that philosophy can pose and create problems, but it can also solve them. And I'm thinking in particular of people like Wittgenstein, who were very keen to the particular kinds of problems in philosophy that philosophy presents itself. He's not the kind of thinker who sees a problem and then tries to answer it in terms of the problem. He actually thinks about what the problem is and then what the conditions of that problem are. And a lot of it is him just kind of almost thinking out loud. When I read the Blue Book and he talks about the philosopher's craving for generality, that's quite a high level of looking at how philosophical problems arise. So he says that philosophers love generalities. They love trying to think of things in universal terms. They assume that because something has a universal term, so for example, chair, all of the objects that we would call chair must have some red thread, must have some universal commonality, because they all use the same word, right? I mean, it makes complete sense. You sit on all of them, or they all have legs, or they're all a kind of furniture for table, or that accompany a table or something like that. They must have some universal thing. But that the philosopher is kind of caught in that desire for generality, for finding the common thread that runs throughout it. Wittgenstein is the kind of person who says, look, the behavior that you're doing here is trying to satisfy a desire for that generality. And you might solve your problem by doing something about that desire for generality. So the therapy comes in. I mean, there's certain ways that you could address that desire. There might be kinds of changing of habits and whatnot. But the first thing is, you have to understand that if that's what the problem is, well, now you know what the problem is, and you can start doing something about it. You have a intellectual diagnosis of a problem that would have gone on and on and on. So I found that in terms of trying to diagnose philosophical problems and find them for their vacuity or their non-problematicity, in terms of, like, does this problem really matter to me? I found thinkers like Wittgenstein very helpful. And it's nice because in philosophy, there are some problems that really do matter. There are some irreconcilable problems, like in ethics, that's quite, well, the matter is quite blurred there. And what is a problem might actually be a sort of meaningful problem. It's not just something you can kind of diagnose away, but it's good because it actually helps you to discern what are the problems that are real problems versus, like, trying to reconcile mind and body. That's not really a problem that I care about. Maybe scholars care about it because they're trying to, you know, do the research on what Descartes actually thought about it. Or maybe there are people who really do believe in substance dualism and they have to explain certain phenomena. But substance dualism is not a metaphysical problem that sort of matters to me because I've seen what the conditions for the problems are. And that's been helpful. I've had philosophical problems in the past, like epistemological problems. You know, how do we know, or yeah, how do we know what we know, and why are we justified in knowing that? That used to actually, like, be a problem for me, because I would go to, you know, you would, okay, so I know this, and I know it for this reason. Okay, I know X for the, I know X. Why do I know X? Why? I know Y. Why do I know Y? Z. Why do I, etc. It just goes on. You have this endless chain of justifications, and that you can't solve that. That just seems to be a problem built into like knowing that of these chains of justification. That was a real problem for me. And again, Wittgenstein kind of came along and helped me to see that he didn't provide answers within the terms of it, but he showed that those problems might not be as problematic as you might think, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it here, but, you know, one thing it does kind of make me think about what you're saying kind of relates my mind back to people we've talked about many times. Heidegger had kind of a similar approach where it's like there are certain problems that are, like, especially particularly traditionally philosophical problems, problems of universals, like you talked about problems of mind bodies, like classic issues that only, it's this kind of thing where it's like, does the problem only arise from a philosophical mindset, or do we first confront a problem and then take a philosophical mindset to that problem, right? And I think sometimes the way, like, I think about it is like, okay, how do we understand mind body, for example? Like, how is that even, you know, the dualism there? And it's like, okay, it's in a sense that's like an interesting academic issue, and we can argue about it, and we can look at texts, we can look at the kind of forefathers of that problem, like you're talking about Descartes and stuff like that. But like, as a person, whatever that is, living their lives, going through and doing things, it doesn't actually come up as an issue. Like, that's like, it's only a problem that arises from a very particular kind of philosophical mindset and perspective on the world. Normally we're immersed in ourselves and the world around us, doing the things that we do, you know, practically living out in the world. And those sorts of issues, like, aren't actually super relevant, it kind of seems like. I mean, I want to be careful, though, because that doesn't mean that they're actually, not a problem and not solvable. But there's a way in which, like, or I should say that not that they're not solvable, but that they, you know, they can't be seriously thought about. But on the flip side of that, there's a part of me that kind of sometimes thinks like they don't actually matter that much in terms of, like, you sort of entered this conversation with, like, discussing problems that are, like, actually philosophically relevant to you and how that helps you, like, you know, how is philosophy useful in that way? And those sorts of issues are not those kinds of problems. Like, they are not particularly useful. And I hesitate in saying that because I don't want to enter this sort of realm where it's like, oh, well, philosophy is only about, you know, super practical means to ends sort of stuff, right? But, you know, I'm also very, I also think, like, a lot of really complex metaphysical or particular issues, you know, end up being sort of knots and confusion and webs of their own making a little bit, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it ties into, so one of the things that specifically I'm thinking of Michael Williams, he wrote a great text on, it's an introductory text to epistemology, but it also gives you several solutions, or it gives you his kind of Wittgensteinian solution to, you know, the infinite regress problem and whatnot. One of the things that he made me realize is that actually the skeptical challenge, that's what we'll call the skeptical challenge is the challenge of, is knowledge even possible given, you know, the infinite regress and circularity and dogmatism and whatnot. The skeptical challenge actually takes a lot of stage setting, right? You have to admit to many premises before you actually arrive at the problem of skepticism. You have to admit that knowledge requires justification, and that justification is based on reasoning and whatnot. So there's a lot of foregrounding taken for granted. And this might be similar to things like, you know, what you're saying, the cobwebs of something like a kind of irrelevant metaphysics to someone's life. Someone might be given these metaphysical kind of axioms and be presented with a problem, but those might actually just be completely foreign admissions to that person's life. Like, okay, so here's the thing, mind and body can't, you know, only body can interact with body and only mind can interact with mind. And as soon as you agree to this, then there becomes a problem of mind-body interaction. Okay, well, those might not be premises that admit existentially into a person's life. And so a problem arises because someone comes along and introduces this problem. Now, I think that philosophy uses these problems for a kind of, I want to say, like, an intelligence or a gymnastics of the intelligence in a way. In philosophy, we immerse ourselves in philosophical problems because they're useful places for exercising the intelligence. I'm not saying, because I don't believe in mind-body dualism, that Descartes' problem isn't worth going through. It's worth reading. It's worth thinking through, and it's worth challenging yourself to try and understand and maybe even solve. But when it comes to, okay, are these problems meaningful for me. And I think that's what one of the sort of supplements that you might want to add is, these might be important for other people, but they're not meaningful for me. When I think about what urges me on to do philosophy, it's not these kind of scholastic metaphysical problems. It's not these highly constructed issues. The axioms on which the problems that matter to me are given in my life. And that's the place from which I can't just brush off axioms. You know, I live in a particular situation. I live with particular people and I have certain relationships. Maybe I have certain skills that I can or can't do. There are certain ideas that I'm preoccupied with or projects that I want to fulfill. All of those are given kind of axioms that you follow up through your, and that's kind of what makes some philosophical reasoning meaningful in a way, or it seems like that should be one way of engaging in a meaningful philosophical engagement with ideas, that they're kind of based on that given.
Yeah. Can I introduce a example from my own life as a way of kind of illustrating this a little bit, what you're saying? Because you're absolutely right. And you know, as you're speaking, there are times when, you know, I like to think I have a certain philosophical mindset or interest. So some of these, like, deeper existential questions certainly have effectively bothered me and, like, have left me, you know, thinking lots about them and trying to figure them out and stuff like that. But also, too, it's like, what was I going to say? There's something kind of almost frustrating around the fact that in philosophy, especially with those sorts of issues, there never seems to be any sort of satisfying conclusion, which I sometimes think is like, and I'll get into it, because sometimes there are more satisfying conclusions. You're saying, like, sometimes people have this tendency to think in philosophy that you just go around in circles constantly and constantly, and you're never going to get anywhere. And I think that's a bit of a fallacy in and of itself. You know, there's this sort of stretch for nirvana effectively a lot of times in philosophical thinking, where it's like we have to come up with, like, the perfect absolute answer. And if you don't come up with that, then basically the work that you've done is worthless. However, I think in a lot of other, like, philosophical realms, particularly in those dealing with human relations, i.e. stuff like ethics, that, like, you can see progress in terms of, you know, more thought out and clear sort of conclusions being come to, whether it be on a large scale or for individuals. And one that particularly thinks a little bit about me that's very personal, and like you said, there's these kind of personal axioms, these rules that are given for a particular person's life, given in their particular context and what they're interested in, what they're doing, where they are, you know, all the details going on. But, you know, for me, I think specifically about, I work in social services, if our listeners didn't know, and I particularly work with populations who, I think, to be frank, a lot of people would struggle to work with, generally because, you know, there are populations that struggle a lot with, you know, stuff like very severe addictions, very severe mental health issues, but also a lot of very severe behavioral issues, issues that, you know, it's not like, no one's going to sit here and say they're good, right? You know, stuff like effectively describe by most people as criminality is very common. For one reason or another, I see a lot of times people discussing populations that I work with, kind of people that I work with, in an incredibly dismissive manner, sort of like a narrative of sort of like, well, you know, they do bad stuff, so toss them, you know, to the side, right? Or they don't deserve what the help, or they don't deserve whatever, right? That basically, like, you know, reiterating the story, like, they do bad things, that, you know, they, this population in general is bad stuff, so basically screw them, they don't deserve help, blah, 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 blah. And I even have heard this from people interacting in my personal life. And it was actually something that like I was struggling with a little bit, which was, you know, why am I working to help people who can be really difficult, for lack of a better way of saying it, can be really difficult, really challenging. It can be not always, you know, I know that sometimes that in the past and perhaps currently they struggle with some really even perhaps disturbing behaviors and outlooks. And even some of that is like thrust upon me, like personally, in personal interactions, which are most definitely not described as being positive. So there's been moments where I've kind of thought, you know, what am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? What am I doing here? A moment where I felt my philosophical mindset and, you know, the work that I've done really come up was, you know, one day when I was work, I was doing my thing, dealing with populations that I work with, you know, in general being difficult, whatever it might be. And I realized, you know, the populations that I work with are most definitely suffering. There's no question about that. You know, it's an important human behavior and reflective of one's moral stance to help people who are struggling, in particular people who like aren't easy to help. So that's part one of it, right? You know, it's one thing to help someone who's going to pay you a bunch of money or be super thankful or become your best friend or whatever it is. You know, that, you know, we've got an almost Kantian notion here where it's like, you know, doing good things, knowing you'll get good stuff out of it, whether it be a good reaction or a thanks or, you know, some sort of reward. You know, it's still good that people do that kind of thing, but I've always thought that the moral worth becomes kind of dubious when that stuff is well known.
Yeah, so I mean, that's not his whole point, but one of the upshots of Kantian ethics is that your goodness is not mixed.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, the goodness is kind of mixed.
Yeah, and, you know, and then obviously, you know, versus working with a population that's where you know, obviously I'm getting paid, so it's a little more complicated than that, my own work. But, like, actually dealing with the people I mean surrounded by populations I work with, you know, I'm not going to get rewards from them. I'm often going to be like, even though I'm trying to do something positive, I'm often going to be negatively treated in some sort of way by the people I'm trying to help. But I think the second realization I came to, and I think the more important one is just because people do bad things in their lives, again, be very general, doesn't mean that I'm here to punish them for it. And I think that's we've developed this sort of collective notion of punishment, right? Like obviously there is the judicial system that we rely upon, which I think, you know, has its problems, but it's, you know, generally legitimate, where we go through a well-reasoned structure to understand what someone did and, you know, respond properly. But we also have the secondary structure, which is far more social, which is basically a kind of social alienation, right? Or a kind of collective social, you know, I guess you just call it social punishment, right? And it kind of came to the realization that, like, I don't actually need to participate in that. Like, I don't have to, just because I know someone, like say I'm working with someone who I know has a long criminal history, right? Which is actually quite common. I don't need to like treat them differently or, you know, not want to work with them or not want to help them, even though they are still suffering, just because they have some kind of criminal past, right? Like I'm not like morally required to effectively mistreat people in that way. And that was like a huge realization for me, because I think it's very natural for everyone to jump into like to kind of jump on the blaming bandwagon, right? Oh, don't you know that so and so did X, so you shouldn't talk to them, you shouldn't hang out with them, you shouldn't help them, all this kind of stuff. And that always just seemed very I guess I would call morally shallow,
Yeah, right? it definitely lacks a kind of moral imagination. It's framed in this like good versus bad. Well, you shouldn't deal with bad people, and that's what the moral person would do. There's a bit of a shallowness or one dimensionality to it.
Well, and you say exactly, you're saying, oh, you should, it's this good and bad. You shouldn't help, and you know, you shouldn't help bad people. But it's like, you know, it's one thing to help bad people do bad things and be involved in that kind of thing. It's another thing to just like generally care for and care about people who have done bad stuff and might still do bad things, right? But again, coming to that kind of that deontological notion that, like, you know, duty doesn't lie in like doing stuff, you know, because it's effectively easy and good and I'll get something, like, you know, and some, basically some good will come of it, and in particular might come back around to me. It's like, you know, no, perhaps, you know, there's a sort of duty that's deeper than that is just to care for those who are suffering, right? It's like, it's like, imagine, you know, perhaps a clear example, imagine a surgeon, you know, he's got several patients lined up. They need immediate surgery. They're very ill. They might pass away. You've got like two people who are, you know, who are outstanding members of society, helpful, cool, easy to deal with, grateful. You know, perhaps they'll even donate to the hospital afterwards. Maybe they'll even become your friend. You know, they're so thankful, and you actually get along with them super well. Great, amazing. Surgeon wants to do the surgery for them. Then we've got someone who's physically, his hip is kind of gross, right? You know, smelly, dirty. Behaviors are difficult, is crabby, snappy, out there, difficult to deal with, openly doesn't like you, right? Or doesn't like the doctor, whatever it might be. It's just generally kind of difficult. You know, it would seem very morally strange for me, the doctor, to say, you know what, I don't feel like doing surgery for you. Like, I'm not going to help you because, like, you're kind of annoying and you're difficult and you're mean. And it's like, you know, again, coming back to that, like from my own position compared to that, like realizing like I'm not a judge and I'm not an executioner, right? Like that's basically it. And so I don't need to do that. And as a matter of fact, I actually think it's wrong to take that kind of stance.
Right. Like it's interesting that you've become aware of it. And now because you're aware of it, entering into it would be questionable.
I also think it brings up a questions around suffering, right? That we've talked about before, where, I don't think we have talked about this before. Where basically, I think we have a tendency to think about things very black and white, think about things in terms of good and evil, and in this weird way, only good people suffer. And I think that's probably a big philosophical question, is like, we don't in our stories and our narratives and our history, we have a tendency to sort of always frame suffering as the suffering of the individual who has some sort of like good merit about them. And that's what makes the suffering in and of itself, right? We tend to emphasize that, like, suffering of people like that. And yet, people who don't really fit that mold, you know, it's almost as if we kind of don't recognize their suffering as being the same kind of thing. It's often displayed as being a kind of ploy to, like, you know, get things, or, you know, it's a manipulation tactic or whatever it might be. And I also think that that's just... it's just a very like narrow and simplistic view of what suffering actually looks like, whatever that concept really is.
Yeah. Yeah, the distinction there. Before we get into that, I just want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show,